gentlemen, thank you for stopping by Red Ice Radio. I'm your host, Henrik, from Sweden. And this is an independent radio program that goes far and casts a wide net in regards to many of the topics that we discuss, investigate, try to understand better, and that we invite researchers and authors to talk more about. RedIceCreations.com, RedIceRadio.net, and RedIceMembers.com are the websites where you can check out our archives and follow our work more closely. Well, today we have a treat for you. Thomas Rausel, the filmmaker behind From Runes to Ruins, is with us to talk about Anglo-Saxon pagan culture and their close relatives in the north. Thomas has a master's degree in medieval history, and he's always been fascinated by the same mythology and legends that inspired J.R.R. Tolkien to write The Lord of the Rings. Delving through old leather books and countless journals trying to discover more about the forgotten religion of the Anglo-Saxon pagans. From Runes to Ruins lights a new spark of interest that gives us further insight into the heathen beliefs of the Anglo-Saxon ancestors of England, and also encourages people to look at the land itself as a beautiful spiritual inheritance which brings us closer to nature, our ancestors, and each other. Thomas, welcome. Thank you so much for coming on with us. It's great to have you on the program. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me, Henrik.
You bet. This is going to be interesting. I watched your film not too long ago. I think it was about a month ago, a little bit more, and I should have taken more notes. I rented it, and at the time I didn't know I was going to invite you to the show, but I do recall a lot of the things in the film, and it's just very well made, and we have so much to discuss. We share a passion and an interest concerning our pagan past, if you will, in Northern and Western Europe. But maybe you could tell us first a little bit, Thomas, about your interest in this topic and how you ended up on this track.
Well, I think this is a very important topic, especially in terms of in the function of history as giving an identity to people today and giving them dignity. And I originally came interested in it through my background was media, so I was working as a journalist. I'd done a media degree. I did a bit of filmmaking and documentary making too, and I just spent a lot of my free time looking up history, and the kinds of history that influenced me were often things that were religious and spiritual, sort of that kind of thing. And obviously one of the most well documented forms of pre-Christian spirituality and belief in Europe is to be found in the sagas and the Eddas. So I had a interest in the Norse stuff, and I had I was raised a Catholic, but in school, I remember when I was 8 or 9 years old, my teacher said that when we started doing the Greek myths that this was my calling. She said there was something that I was suddenly, things like Heracles, Achilles, Odysseus, these are really your experiences at a visceral level. These are really archetypes of the European soul, these kind of characters. And I absolutely adore Greek myth, but then Norse myth didn't become interested until early adulthood. And then through that became interested in what I could find out about, my people, English people. Not just Greeks and Scandinavians. So what did we have? And obviously we don't have as much as the Greeks or the Swedes, but we have some. We have Beowulf, for example. And what we know from archaeology and from the sources of Old English sources is that there's quite a strong similarity with the Norse peoples, what the Anglo-Saxons have there. Origins in Denmark anyway, and in northern Germany. So the culturally and spiritually there was some connections, and I found that very interesting. And eventually I went broke away from my job in media and went back to university, studied a master's degree in the kind of topics that I've been researching in my own free time anyway, Viking history, Anglo-Saxon history. And after coming out of that master's degree, I decided to make a film with some friends about that, which is the film we're discussing today, From Runes to Ruins.
Very interesting. Yeah, exactly. There's a lot there. Tell us more about, you mentioned we, do you think we lack identity today, dignity?
I think that there's definitely a problem, especially with young people. I mean, I remember when I was in secondary school, you know, there were a lot of people were depressed, suffering from depression. There were suicides, drug addiction. And this is, I came from like not a too bad area. And I know from across the country and across Europe and the West, there's so many instances of these kind of phenomena in young people where they just feel rootless and they have no meaning in their life and they're given a roadmap of the potentials in their life and it doesn't have any appeal to them at all. And I think that's because they're being expected to grow without roots and that it's been proven even by some psychologists, I mean, that a child who is given some understanding of his past, of the past of his family and of his country, of his people, whatever, is likely to have higher self-esteem. And that higher self-esteem gives you confidence, ability to, you know, take on tasks with, you know, with the belief that you can accomplish them. And that is something that other, you know, ethnic groups in the world have held on to, and they know it's true, and they've rightfully, you know, preserved their customs and cultures and celebrate their histories and the origins of their peoples in order to, you know, to for the benefit of their children and their and for coming generations. So it's something that we have to learn from them.
Yeah, you bet, exactly. I mean, how are the British, would you say, when it comes to their history and what they're taught, and if they're learned to be proud of it? Because, I mean, we have a disconnect in Sweden for sure, but I guess in Britain you have also a lot to choose from, I guess. I mean, from the Celts or Druids to, you know, the Iceni to the Romans later, then to the Angles and Saxons. I mean, you can kind of pick and choose, I guess, what you kind of identify with, right?
Unfortunately, there's a kind of tendency, I don't know, I think it's still around, we used to call, I think some history teachers call it the three H's, which is Henry VIII, Hitler, and the Holocaust. The only things that you learn.
Right.
It's really the whole of history. Like, the Henry VIII is important because, you know, it's the start of the English Church, and we often learn, you know, a bit about the foundations of Parliament. And Cromwell and such, and then the rest is mostly the First and Second World Wars, and often those are only taught in the context of the suffering of civilians in Britain during the war effort, and the sufferings of civilians in Europe, and atrocities, whatever, but not with any kind of geopolitical consciousness of why those wars took place, or only with some kind of, you know, sort of puerile moralizing about the things, which you don't really learn anything about our history. We don't, especially don't learn origin myths or anything like that, except those which perpetuate and reinforce the national myths that have become popular in recent decades.
Yeah. Well, same in Scandinavia for sure. These have become kind of pillars of our world today, and everything kind of stands and it begins and ends with that, it seems like. But how come you honed in on the Angles and Saxons then? Was it something in particular that just kind of attracted you to this? I mean, obviously many of the sites over there are from that period. They brought obviously a new kind of you know, they brought the barrows or the kurgans, if you will, in a different way of life, obviously, in the, I don't know when they arrived, migration age 400 or 500, something like that, I guess.
Sure. The barrows were important to me because, I mean, during adolescence, I wasn't a very spiritual person, you know, sort of going out for drinks with the lads kind of thing. But the oftentimes we'd go up, you know, to places, because I grew up in the countryside, we'd go to barrows and living in Oxfordshire, Berkshire, there's so much like ancient history, not just Anglo-Saxon, but I mean Neolithic barrows, like thousands of years old. And so that's actually, I have to point out that the Anglo-Saxons did bring a barrow culture, like the from Scandinavia, but there was already one present here, which was thousands of years old.
Yeah,
so that's not Celtic even, that's pre-Celtic, that's something that goes into primordial history. So there, and they built them side by side. In fact, there's like, you know, this barrow is from Germanic people, this one's from indigenous people or whatever. But I always liked these, you know, big grassy mounds, spookily placed on top of hills, and the sort of ambient pregnant quality about them. You know, there's something, this makes the environment that I was growing up in alive. But I didn't take too much of a historical interest in it. I didn't read any books about it or anything. But, you know, when I was going through a phase of, you know, research during my, after work in my early 20s, that was the sort of thing I was like picking up on, the stuff that I could identify. Because I always, like, when I was at primary school, my curriculum was a bit different because I went to a Catholic school, so I got to learn a lot, a bit more about religions and stuff. And I really loved, you know, as I said, the Greek myths, and I knew a bit about the Aztec myths as well. I thought those were really cool, the Aztec gods.
Right.
So when I obviously carried on this a bit because I became interested in spirituality, and like pre-Christian spiritual traditions mainly from around the world. But then, whenever I sort of saw an opportunity to connect one to something to my own upbringing, to my own area, to my own people, that was something I was, you know, interested in. So barrows and things and such, when I was looking at that kind of thing, and I picked up on it, and then I became more and more interested in Anglo-Saxons and the Norse because those were things that I could identify with. It was somehow simultaneously exotic and, you know, mysterious, but also familiar and domestic.
Right, yeah. Well, it's very interesting. You know, there's so much history there, and I've always been fascinated by this period as well. And you mentioned Beowulf, one of my my favorite, obviously, and it kind of seems to connect, obviously, the both your land and mine, because he was a Geat, or he was Geatish or Goth. There's many different versions of this name today that you spell it, but it seems like the only reason why it survived is that it was a story that had been passed down, and the Angles and the Saxons took that with them when they, you know, went over to Britain. And eventually, I think in the 7th or 8th century, perhaps, it was written down by, I don't know if they were Christian at the time. Had it been Christianized already by that time? Do you know?
It was certainly written by Christians. The date of composition is a hot topic among scholars. So, I mean, I won't speculate on it, but it's definitely, at least, you know, 9th century latest, you're talking, so
right,
maybe earlier. But and then, it, of course, whenever it was written down, we know for sure that it's based on an older story, so it's something that people were familiar with. But it was certainly written by a Christian for a Christian audience, but one that had still had a culture of talking about pagan heroes and pagan past in celebrating them around the table. And we find this a lot in, like, complaints. Like, one complaint from a bishop was that he says, Quidenim Enildius con Christo, writing, saying, what does Ingeld, one of the Germanic heroes, have to do with Christ? And he's getting fed up with all these people, sort of, you know, monks and whatnot, like Christian people. When they get around the table, have a few ales, they're not talking about the Bible. They start talking about their heroic ancestors of Denmark and right, you know, who were all pagans. And he's thinking, you know, these people are all in hell. Why are we celebrating these people from hell when we should be talking about the Old Testament? But it's something about, even among, in a Christian society, something about, it was, you know, for thousands of years, ancestor worship had been the norm, and that didn't just die out overnight. That's something that was still important to Christian Anglo-Saxons, and to the extent that a scholarly Christian could take the time to write down Beowulf for us to enjoy today.
Well, exactly. Well, you know, thank God for that. That having been said, though, do you think, because I notice the language, too, when you read certain, you know, passages, they talk about the Lord or, you know, God as opposed to maybe gods and things. Has it been rewritten, do you think, in that context of the time, perhaps?
Oh, yeah, there's definitely, I mean, there's explicit references to Christianity, you know, where every now and then in Beowulf he says stuff about that, you know. And it's written from a Christian perspective. So obviously it would have been told differently, 100 years prior and 200 years prior. So oral traditions have a way of being changed a bit, you know, Chinese whispers a bit. But he's writing it from the perspective that they're pagans. So he might try and excuse their actions or something for a Christian audience, but he's not going to impose too much of a Christian narrative into the story because it's not necessary. The assumption is by everyone listening that these people are all in hell. So the only thing necessary to do is denounce paganism itself, not to change the story to fit a Christian narrative.
Wow. What do you think about that before we move along here and talk a little bit more about the film? But is that something which has, I know a lot of people talk about this, from a point of view of a European ancient spirituality and our connection, not only to the land, but to our people in itself. Is Christianity that something has kind of, it's coming and put a wedge between us and our past, do you think?
In a way, you could say that that's a narrative that can be used, but I'm not a sort of anti-Christian. I mean, I was raised Catholic, and I'm glad of it, because I don't think I'd be any the better if I'd been an atheist or non-religious upbringing at all, because it gives you moral direction and at least an acceptance of the potential for divinity, which I believe in. I'm not an atheist. So, but also, yes, there were things lost. That was a problem. The early Christians were very evangelical and very destructive, and they were keen to get rid of all paganism. So, but they didn't succeed, because it changed. Christianity was changed, and everyone knows that. Like, there's so many examples of, you know, native culture influencing and being incorporated into this imported religion. It's become quite, in Britain, and I'm sure to other parts of Europe as well, it's become settled on us, and it's not something that we can shed off like a skin. It's something that's part of us now, the Christian religion. But just as paganism was and wasn't shed or got rid of, there was no overnight conversion. There was a gradual process of theological change of perspective, but the culture remained. And I have noticed, for example, in The Dream of the Rood, the poem, an Anglo-Saxon poem, Christian poem, which I've talked about on YouTube videos and in the film, From Ruins to Ruins, there's this cross in Scotland covered in Anglo-Saxon runes, which have this poem, and that full poem is written in a manuscript which is held in Italy. It's written in Old English, and it's depicting Jesus like a pagan warrior, like an Anglo-Saxon pagan warrior. It describes him as Yeung Halef, meaning, you know, the young warrior. And the tree is conscious. The tree, even before it's been cut down and turned into a cross to crucify Jesus, the tree is conscious and is like a living entity, which is something, you know, this is very animistic. This is from animism, right?
Yeah.
And then also the tree is likened to a warrior, one of like his retinue, with, you know, with Christ as the chief. And that kind of themes, I mean, that's very, very, you could only have that from a Germanic culture. And, you know, even though it's an entirely Christian poem, the bricks are Christian, the mortar's pagan, put it like that. And whatever direction the spiritual path of Western man takes, it won't change what path we've taken in the past. We've been Christians for a time, and before that we were pagan, and maybe we'll be, who knows what in the future, but those two things will be a part of it, and part of the identity of a Western man is pagan, and part of it is Christian.
Well, hopefully we can evolve away from our modern religion, but maybe we can talk more about that later. But yeah, the dual faith, I think some called it, and it was it seems to have been many different places. Eastern Europe, the Baltic state too, they had they were practically side by side. I think one of the things that plagues me about it is how incredibly bloody it seems to have been when Christianity came in, and I guess that's still to this day where I feel that so much has been lost, it seems like, because it was brought in with such force and violence, and it's a disturbing episode because of that. But of course it doesn't mean that what we have gone through is not something we should just try to forget about. That's not what I mean either, you know.
I guess, well, we have records, you know, of the violence done against pagans, like in on the continent, you know, Charlemagne and against the Saxons, and I think Olaf Tryggvason in Scandinavia, he was pretty violent as well.
Oh yeah,
In the Orkneys, I know he was kidnapping children and force, you know, and like bribing, blackmailing people into, you know, as hostage. You'd say, I'll kill your children if you don't convert. It's like, that is brutal. But we don't actually have any record of that kind of behavior in England ever happening. And it seems, well, some people have read into that, that the conversion was much more peaceful in Britain, but it might just be we don't have any record of it. But I suspect that it was something like the way Hindus, when English people in India talked to Hindus about Christianity, they just said, oh, this sounds like a good guy. We'll just put him next to Shiva in the temple.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't get rid of their gods. And actually, there is a record of something like that happening in Anglo-Saxon. Bede writes about it, I think, when they just kept, you know, they put Thunor and Woden, whatever, in their temple. And then they said, yeah, put Jesus next to him. He's a nice god. So we'll add him with the others. There was no distinction. And I think that the best way of seeing pre-Christian religions is not really as religions as we now know them. You know, Islam and Christianity, even though they have a common source, we divide them clearly into two separate theological perspectives with different traditions. But I don't think that that was really how people thought in Europe before Abrahamic theology came into the equation. The Romans and the Greeks definitely, you know, made thought of their gods as equivalent. And they even, take non-Indo-European gods into it, like from Egypt. And certainly, I'm sure that in Scandinavia, they would not have, you know, they could have, if they come into contact with the Sami, they might have incorporated shamanic beliefs into Norse paganism. Or if, like, different Germanic tribes in Germany had varying, like, perspectives on gods or varying myths, that the two were not seen as conflicting. You know, if someone said that this and that, they didn't have a fight over it. There's never any evidence for that kind of conflict, because it was, they were all probably seen as one religion, or if, well, not as the word religion as we mean it, but there is one divine truth and many different ways for it to be understood by different peoples, and different names can be given to the same forces, the same divine forces.
Yeah, let's spend some time talking about the film, and we can definitely get into some of the places and events that you highlight as well. But first, just tell us why you wanted to make the film, Thomas.
Oh, well, after I finished my master's, I thought, well, I've got a degree in medieval history and I've got a degree in filmmaking, so I'll combine the two. But originally I wanted someone else to present it, and I wanted a production house to do it, and I thought I'd just write a treatment. And I got, you know, I got some high profile meetings with, like, I was in the BBC offices and things, but none of the major networks I contacted in the end took it, although some expressed interest. And I decided, rather than give up on the project and try another one, which is what some people said, like, whatever ideas do you have, I really want to go ahead with this, because this is something I believe in. I think this is something that, I think, film is such a great medium of communication, and it's becoming cheaper and easier to make high quality films. And this is a subject that a lot of people want to know about, but I think a lot of people need to know about, because it gives some grounding and context to everything that they experience in life. So I thought that, you know, this is the perfect, I have a friend who worked at a production house, could get hold of the equipment. We both experienced in filmmaking, so we just went ahead and made From Ruins to Ruins.
Yeah, I think it's good that you did it this way, I gotta say, because usually, what usually happens, obviously you would have still had control of the production, so I'm not saying that, but when it seems this very formulaic and very, it kind of turns out in the same way and the same things are focused on. It feels like you had free hands to do what you want. And for example, one thing I like is that you give a lot of space to the landscape, to the land of showing, you know, the environments, showing, you know, how things look, and giving time and space. And you kind of, you're let into the film in this way. You're not, as most films are today, super busy, you know, hectic music, and they're like shutting you out almost. This is very inviting, and it's easy to just kind of fall right into it. I really like that about the film, you know.
Thank you very much. I definitely wanted it to be like that, because for personal taste, I don't like fast editing. I don't like shaky cam. I don't like, you know, all these kind of swooshing noises when it's cut, every time it cuts. I don't understand the point of it. The point, this is for people with very slow attention spans, but I don't think that kind of editing and filmmaking is conducive to leaving a lasting impression. I hope that people can actually use this to learn something. So I really love, like, some documentary filmmakers, like Kenneth Clark's Civilization series, if you've ever seen it. That's like, it doesn't even, he has long pauses and lets the architecture of the art or speak for itself, or the landscapes, and he doesn't feel the need to cram in as much narration into every edit as he can, every cut as he can. It's slowly paced, but you're not starved of information. There's so much fact, you know, so much information to take on board, that these gaps in the slow pace give you a chance to absorb it and sort of take it all on. So I hope that was something that, you know, a bit more of a slow pace editing in that sense. And the soundtrack was provided by three different people. Two of them, one of them's a friend, and one of them's a Finnish or Norwegian, I think, dungeon synth artist. And like, I wanted it all to be kind of synth, so it had a theme, because I have a personal love of old 80s horror movies and things like that. Right. I think that sound, like, it's really good. It's powerful.
Like the John Carpenter style or something? No. Yeah, it's cool. It's good.
Thank you. It's a little bit less dramatic than John Carpenter's music, though, but, you know, the same kind of sound.
Right, exactly. So let's just kind of get into some of the things that you highlight. Obviously, there's an endless amount of sites and events to talk about. And how did you go about picking some of the things that you did? And obviously, later we can talk about, you know, you do separate shorter videos on you know, certain, you know, issues you go into, you know, some of the finds and, you know, at Sutton Hoo and, you know, other, you know, small shorter videos that are really where you can go into other territory, I guess. But for the sake of the film, tell us about some of the places you picked that you wanted to highlight and some of the events and whatnot.
Well, most of the locations were picked on the basis of my experience with them. So I didn't actually visit anywhere I hadn't been before shooting. So the Skuttermas Knob, the opening place, is the barrow I mentioned earlier that I used to get drunk on as a teenager. And that was, I thought, a good start, because it's sort of, for me, it's a personal, a location of personal significance. And also, it's a very old barrow from, you know, the pagan times. And so it's good to kind of like give that, you know, context for the start of it. And then other ones are nearby, close, like the White Horse Hill is close by, and it's also significant, and it also has a significance in Anglo-Saxon history, but to a later time, to the period of Viking invasions, because that's allegedly when King Alfred started preserving it. And also things like the Roughwell Cross, which is actually in what's now Scotland, but it's the oldest example of the English language that we have, which is the runic cross I mentioned earlier. And that's actually near where my grandfather's farm was. He's now passed away, but so I was familiar with that area as well. The other ones are kind of, other ones were sort of on the way between different places. Oh, one of them, there's a village called Thursley, which Thursley means like the clearing, like the sacred grove of Thor. Well, what the Anglo-Saxon equivalent of Thor, which is called Thunor. And that village is next door to the village that I grew up in when I was a young child, and I was at primary school. And so I was familiar with that. And in the center of the village, they've got a big wooden pole with a depiction of Thor on the top of it, holding his hammer. And that's important as well, because like that shows, you know, that they kept the place names named directly after the gods. So, and I went through a list of other locations that were en route to between other locations that were named after Anglo-Saxon pagan deities, so that we could stop there and get some shots. So there's one, for example, called Wansdyke, which comes from Wodensdyke, which was a military fortification, but clearly had some kind of spiritual significance to be named after a god. But it was a god of war, after all, so perhaps that would explain it.
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of names, obviously, many of them that end with like by, which means village in Swedish, or like Grimsby, for example. And obviously, that's right at the eastern shore, so that would probably be around some of the places where they would have arrived at. But there's others. I was looking at the map the other day of England, like even Suffolk and Norfolk is obviously North Folk and South Folk, stuff like that. It's remarkable how many places have been kept. Actually, it's great.
Yeah, I mean, most place names in England are Anglo-Saxon origin. Very few are of Celtic linguistic connection. I mean, like Gloucestershire, for example, the Gloch part, that's Celtic, but then the rest is Anglo-Saxon. Then there's along the east, northeast coast, like you get places with B, as you said, which are those are Norse settlements, Viking settlements. So those are later, and they're mostly in the Danelaw, which is the part which was of northeastern England, which was occupied by the Vikings. But they're, the vast majority are all Anglo-Saxon, and they've been preserved for a really long time. And also, if you fly, I'm sure you've flown to England before.
Yeah.
When you look over the top of it, the way that the fields are laid out, even today, correspond, except up in Norfolk, which is more modern industrial farming, but the rest of the country, it corresponds to the old system of Anglo-Saxon farming, and the roads sort of intersect in these weird ways, which don't make sense from many modern planning perspectives because they are early medieval, and they've been kept for all these centuries. I find that's one of the most charming things about England to me.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of things are cut up. I forget the names now, but there are, you divide it up in, hundreds or hundreds or something?
Yeah, hundreds are like systems of towns with the amount of people they had. I think it's burgle hidage is the expression for, the burg is a town. Yeah, and burgle hidage is a list of fortified places that the burgs are the forts, and I guess the hundreds are the populations for each place. But I can't remember that.
That's but right. It's sorry to interrupt, but yeah, that's right. It just came to me. We call it härad in Swedish anyway, and I think it's related to hundred because that's actually the amount of men that you could amass from one territory to go fight. I think. Yeah.
This was actually this is late Anglo-Saxon period when they're trying to defend against Viking invasions, but the names of places like Wansdyke, those are from the pagan Anglo-Saxon times, so they're hundreds of years before the Vikings came, because by the time the Vikings first started invading England, England was Christian. So, stuff that has survived from the Viking era is impressive, but to me it's even more impressive that there's early Anglo-Saxon pagan stuff that survived.
Yeah.
And really that was the focus of my documentary, is that it's the pagan religion that existed in England prior to the Christianization of the Anglo-Saxons.
Exactly. And obviously, I've always wondered this too, because there's so many of the same people, really, just separated by time, I would say, that have gone over to England. And I'm still, because obviously there was peaceful relations between Scandinavia and England, the people there before that.
Trade
has to have going on at some point here, because the Vikings starts in 790, something like that, and before that it seems that there were peaceful trade places. There's even obviously very, very similar correlations between, for example, the Vendel period in Sweden and the finds at Sutton Hoo, for example, right? So, what do you think about the connection there?
I've always often wondered, I'd like to know more about why there's such a similarity between the Sutton Hoo findings and certain other findings in Kent and what's found in the Vendel periods of Sweden, which is before the Viking Age as well. So they're pretty much contemporary, but they're such a long distance. So I think there was some kind of cultural connection between Eastern Sweden, and Eastern England, which is very interesting. And obviously there was trade. I mean, the History Channel series, The Vikings, it's laughable when it depicts like them discovering England, which is really insulting. Because I mean, not only did they have it in the early medieval times, but I mean there's evidence of there were Scandinavians going to Greece in the, you know, thousands of years ago.
Yeah.
So like they knew about all of Europe, they knew about everything, even long before the Viking Age. So I mean, even in prehistoric times, the oldest rock carvings in Sweden depict boats. So they were traveling about. But there's also the fact that the missionaries who went to convert the Saxons in Germany, the mainland Saxons, the Christian missionaries from England referred to them as our brothers, our kinsmen. They recognized a kind of ethnic solidarity with this people on the continent who were another religion, who had kept their pagan ways. And that was seen as one of the reasons why they had an obligation to go and convert to Christianity, to the new faith, because they didn't want their ethnic kinsmen to go to hell. But that shows that the Anglo-Saxons probably didn't just come in one wave and live in England and never go back, like it's often depicted in older history books. There was probably long-standing trade routes going from the continent, from northern Germany and Denmark to England, and certainly the art and the archaeology in Kent and East Anglia supports that, because there's so many examples of really typically German and Nordic and Frankish, jewelry and weaponry.
Well, exactly. I mean, when the Goths or the Geats, some of them left during the they left from mid and southern Sweden in during the Migration Age. You had, for example, connectivity between the Estro and Visigoths up with Scandinavia. They all knew where they came from. They had connectivity. That's why you find tons of golds, for example, in Götaland, where they originally came from the 400-500s. And it's not until later Viking period when you begin to when they were starting going after more silver, for example, than gold. So all this is very, you can explain it, because often in archaeology there's a tendency to be very compartmentalized and divided up, like it's, oh, there's a huge difference, you know, between the Vendel period and the Viking Age. And really there isn't, in my view. No. I mean, it's a long string, a continuation. It doesn't just begin out of the blue. I mean, even recent articles have detailed how, they're trying to find, like, okay, when was the first Viking Age? There were, like, you know, places in small islands outside of, like, Estonia and Latvia where show sign that it's the same boats, the same people, and this is like 200 years before the so-called Viking Age begins. So this is very difficult to pin down like that, I would say.
It's just how people understand history, by compartmentalizing every, you know, different eras, and this is the beginning and the end of it. I mean, it's easy to say the end of the Viking Age ended with 1066. That's more reasonable, but it isn't so reasonable to pick a date when it began. I mean, certainly there was, you know, there were Scandinavians trading around Europe, and there's evidence of that, archaeological. And I mean, also that what's most telling to me is the cultural connections. Like in the Icelandic sagas, they're talking about people. They have sagas about the Burgundians and their conflicts with the Huns, and they're talking about them like their kinsmen, like they're just the same way when they have Icelandic sagas.
They emigrated from Scandinavia. The Burgundians tell that. This is the story they tell themselves. The Lombards, same thing. There's tons of these tribes. They just poured out of southern Scandinavia during the Migration Age, you know?
But what's interesting then is that the people of Iceland on the corner of the world knew about that.
Exactly.
And thousands of years later. So, and the fact that they kept those myths, the foundation myths of the Burgundians or the Lombards or other Germanic tribes, and they kept those with them all the way on the other side of the known world, that's telling, because it shows there was some form of not only knowledge of these people, but a kind of sense of kinship, because they're, and it, just like the Anglo-Saxons preserving the Beowulf myth, which is, you know, it's about a guy from Sweden going to Denmark, and it's told not it's told in the way that this is, you know, one of our heroes, you know, even though it's told in England.
Yeah, exactly. So it's passed on. So obviously we were not isolated, and our knowledge of the rest of the world was somehow limited, and because sometimes there is that view that somehow it was not until, you know, Christianity civilized us barbarians that, you know, we could begin to draw the maps and have the languages and everything else. And this is simply not true. I mean, we have, in all likelihood, for example, they probably had, I mean, we know that they have the written language of the runes, obviously, but people think, oh, it's only limited to stones and whatnot. But in all likelihood, they probably used, you know, birch bark as parchments and writing things that actually have been lost through time. That obviously just have disintegrated in the moist and wet climate of Scandinavia over many hundreds of years, you know?
Certainly, it's perfectly possible that there were quite a few literate people, but I don't even think that widespread literacy is a prerequisite for an advanced culture. You don't have to prove that.
Of course not.
I mean,
no.
Even after a long time later, like, I mean, our king, one of the Anglo-Saxon kings, King Alfred the Great, one of the most famous Anglo-Saxon kings, he was literate and very literate and wrote and stuff. But then you can go hundreds of years later after the Norman conquest, and a lot of kings were illiterate. So,
yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
That it wasn't even the presence of Christianity or the Christianized influence is not necessarily increases literacy. And it was a long time, actually, until you had kings, where it was thought necessary for a king to be literate. It wasn't really part of it wasn't part of the culture. So, like, yeah, they have literate people in society because they have a function. Like, we don't all learn how to do plumbing in England at the moment, so we have to get experts to come and do it because it's not really seen as widely necessary for everyone to know it. And it's probably the same then. Like, not everyone needs to be literate in a society where most people are farming or warriors or whatever, or only someone who needs to be like a priest would need that skill. So that's probably why it was like that. So the fact that the Scandinavians, the Norse peoples, built with wood mainly means that a lot of whatever they did build is not there anymore, but you can build absolutely spectacular structures with wood.
Exactly.
So yeah. We have no idea what they might have had, like the scale of the civilization they might have had. It could be huge, and we'll never know for sure unless some great archaeological find emerges.
Well, this is it, and this is, you know, so interesting. We probably should, you know, continue to talk about this in the second hour, but let's spend some more minutes on this before we take a break here. But, you know, there are, well, at least in Scandinavia, there's a lot of sites, a lot of places which are just simply not excavated in certain parts of Sweden anyway. It's specifically southern and midwestern. I'd say a lot of millions have been spent, obviously, on Uppland, around Mälardalen, where we have Birka, where we have Gamla Uppsala, and these areas. But not, unfortunately, a lot of other places there are neglected. There are, for example, barrows that are, you know, in the sizes of those that held the Oseberg ship, for example, in Norway, that just never have been excavated. Now, I would assume still to this day that they, if they would put the efforts in, there are remnants you could find of, for example, large wooden beams or poles that would indicate, you know, temples or settlements and things like this. And I think that the work could be done if the willpower and if the resources were there. I hope it happens
one
day.
I hope the Swedish government take a leaf out of the Danish government's book, because I know that they've recently found a huge Viking fortified town, would have had earthworks surrounding it and then wooden fence behind that, and then all these wooden, like, long houses within it. And interestingly, I learned about a university in England. We found at Yeavering in Northumberland a site which is most likely to be a pagan temple with these posts lined up, which one of my professors thought, well, obviously the posts aren't there anymore, but you can see from using certain, you know, the archaeological techniques, they can tell that there was a post here, a large, you know, a tree posts, and they were all equidistantly spaced and positioned. and that these were probably some kind of religious structures, most likely like actual depictions of gods, because we know that from certain literary sources that that's how Germanic peoples did worship, or they liked to have wooden posts carved with the images of the gods. So, and that was, we can find that in England. I'm sure that in Sweden there would be a lot of that sort of thing, like well preserved as well, because we've had the Industrial Revolution first here before anyone else, and a lot of the rural areas were sort of, places and stuff has been built over. We can't really access it, but in Sweden you've got sort of lots of pristine countryside that could be examined.
Yeah, exactly. The only problem is that a lot of it has been turned into farmland, and a lot of things have been lost. That's actually one of the major ways that finds have been made, for example, in Jötaland, I know, and other Östergötland as well, eastern Jötaland, because so little money has been spent on the archaeology work there that basically that has been left to the whims of farmers. And they've actually managed to dig up more gold this way than all the millions that have been spent on trying to find similar things in, for example, Uppland around Uppsala, which is quite interesting, actually. But
wow.
So let's do this, Tom. Let's just take a short break here, and then we can continue and talk more in the second. I have so much more to ask you about Sutton, who many other remarkable places we need to spend some time on. But let's just give out all the details that people need to know. Not only about how to follow your work and your websites and everything, but how they can watch the film as well.
Okay, you can see the film and learn more about it on runestoruins.co.uk. There's a link there to the VHX website, which you can rent it for $4 and you get access to it for 3 days. You can see, if you haven't got $4 and you don't want to see the full film, you can see loads and loads of videos that you can see for free on my YouTube channel, which is called Survive the Jive. So if you Google that, look for the YouTube. I got a blog and a Tumblr as well for Survive the Jive. But there's a lot of history videos on there. You can learn about the Sutton Hoo burial, which I'll talk about in the second half.
Absolutely. It's well worth the $4, folks. So go see it. We'll have a link up to where you can click directly to the streaming side, if you will, and you can just purchase it right there and watch it thereafter. It's great stuff within it. You learn a lot if you're interested in this period, and specifically then would focus on Anglo-Saxon culture in Britain. But we'll have the links up, folks. Stay with us, Thomas. Stay with us, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be right back after the break. Well, please stay with us for another exciting and informative discussion in the second hour at redicemembers.com for much more on Anglo-Saxon pagan beliefs and how it relates to us today. We have much more to discuss with Thomas, and we go into some territory that we have to go into and discuss what is happening to this tradition today and how to regain the connection to the land and to our ancestors' beliefs, traditions, and way of understanding the world. We speak more about modernity and popular culture a bit too, and how to awaken the sleeping giant that is our connection to the land and our familiarity with the ways of our ancestors in order to gain a new footing in the age of destruction that we are in right now. So don't miss the second hour. Go to redicemembers.com and sign up and tune in if you haven't already, not only to this continuation, but to all our previous shows. We have much more about Norse heritage, also through Vikings and pagans for you to dive into as well. You can see our related programs on this radio show that you're listening to right now for much more. We also have more in the pipeline, of course, with Greg Johnson, Mark Hackard, Jonas De Geer, Sophia Smallstorm, Veronica Clark, and also Ulle Damegård and Jim Fetzer for a follow-up show to the last one we just did with Ulle. We also have Stephen McNallan on his new excellent book, also through a native European spirituality. So stay tuned. Much more to come. But we'll be right back with Hour 2 with Thomas Rausel after a short break.